This is the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown today. Thank you for listening. 46% of Americans believe that the Earth is less than 10,000 years old. And we have ongoing debates about climate change and vaccinations and evolution and so many other things. So much of that comes from what Chris Mooney calls scientific illiteracy. He and Cheryl Kirshenbaum, who's a marine biologist at Duke University, have written a terrific book on a subject called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Chris, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Good to be with you.
One of the themes in your book is not just how Americans are scientifically illiterate, but how we're so easily exploited by our leaders and people who want to be our leaders using scientific illiteracy, right?
Yeah, the two things are closely related. Americans don't know a lot. They're not tuned in to what's going on in the world of science and how it affects them. So, yeah, then they easily have the wool pulled over their eyes, unfortunately, and there's a lot of misinformation out there.
And that comes from believing people who don't themselves know anything about science but know everything about politics and how to exploit their agenda and convince us that they're right.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes these strategies are incredibly sophisticated. So if you take global warming or vaccination or climate change, all of which I've written extensively about, it turns out that people putting out the misinformation, you know, it's hard to recognize what's wrong with what they're saying. It sounds scientific. The scientific community rejects it. But if you don't know that, you can easily be snowed by them.
Yeah, and they often like to say, there's a study that says... Okay, there may be a study that says something, but 99.9% of the scientists who've looked at this say the other thing. And let's talk about vaccinations, because they've been in the news so much in the last few weeks, and so many people are really worried about getting a vaccination for not just the seasonal flu, but especially the H1N1 flu virus. Where is this fear coming from?
Well, I'll take theirs then, you know. It boggles the mind. This is the new, really big science denialism that's so dangerous. And it's about 10 years old. I mean, people have been afraid of vaccination for hundreds of years. And it's also one of the greatest advances of science in terms of, vanquishing diseases and keeping people healthy. So it's really unfortunate that people are still worried about it today. But it comes from this this idea that vaccines contain a mercury-based compound called Tamiflu, which they did. But it was taken out in the early 2000s because of uproar over this, and there was no proof that it was necessarily dangerous anyway. People then claimed that a generation of children had gotten autism because of the mercury compound.
And when you say people, what you really mean is Suzanne Summers and Jenny McCarthy.
Right. Jenny McCarthy with her degree from the University of Google, as she likes to put it. So, to make a long story short, the scientific community, took this claim seriously about autism. They looked at the evidence. A bunch of people have done studies now, and it's been roundly rejected that vaccines have poisoned kids.
Yeah, and these anti-vaxxers who are out there still spreading this lie, why is it so dangerous for them to be doing that? I mean, what if they're just saying, you know what, I still believe it, and so I'm not going to get my own kid vaccinated? Where's the danger to the public in that?
Oh, the danger is that diseases like measles will come back and infect everybody. If you have a community, it varies widely across the United States in terms of how many people want to duck their vaccinations. And there's certain communities in Washington State, Oregon, Boulder, Colorado, a couple other places where there's high proportions of people ducking vaccinations. And when you get a high enough proportion, then you risk the loss of what's called herd immunity, where the number of people vaccinated are basically protecting the unvaccinated because it's hard for disease to catch on.
Mm-hmm.
Once you lose the herd immunity, then everybody can start getting a disease that you thought we'd beaten, and the disease can become endemic again. And it's a disaster, and eventually somebody will die.
So you could say to the anti-vaxxers, look, you may not want to vaccinate your child and say that it's not my business, but it is if my child goes to school with your child and your child has a communicable disease that my child then catches, which wouldn't have been there in the first place if you had just vaccinated your kid.
It's absolutely public business. It is not a private choice. It affects everyone. And the best science is unequivocal that vaccines are overwhelmingly safe and that they are our top line of defense.
So we have a government that, through the schools, demands that children be vaccinated against various diseases, measles, mumps, rubella, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Should the government demand that all Americans who have children of a certain age who are in that risk group be vaccinated?
I think it should. I mean, currently, there are, you know, it's hard to get out of vaccination. You know, you have to make some sort of conscientious objection to it. But the problem is, a religious, you know, objection and so forth. The problem is that the people doing that are rising. So it's still hard to shake loose and not get your shots. More and more people are trying. More and more people are skeptical of the shots. And it's really only a matter of time until, you know, diseases come back. And as I said again, somebody's eventually going to die from one of these diseases.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris, along with Chris Mooney, the author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. All right, right there is one example of how we're threatened by people who don't know what they're talking about, taking advice from other people who don't know what they're talking about. And let's expand that from vaccinations next to climate change. Where's the danger there?
Oh, well, that's the biggest one that affects the whole planet. I mean, we are remaking the entire Earth system. And we don't know what we're doing. And the consequences could be so dramatic that there's nothing like it. You know, if you melt the ice at the poles, then you have a planet where sea levels are dramatically higher, and coastal cities as we know them today won't be able to be located where they're located. I mean, the radical kinds of implications of this, few have wrapped their minds around.
Yeah, but remember, that might mean beachfront property for me in St. Louis.
Right. Right. It might. It also might mean, you know, a dramatic economic and social upheaval. So the science, again, is really clear. And this one is, you know, goes back much older than the thing over vaccines and Tamiflu. It's just basic physics. We know the greenhouse effect. We know how it works. We know that if you increase the concentrations of greenhouse gases, then the planet warms. It's really, really simple stuff. And we've then done the science. We know we've increased the concentrations, we know the planet's warming, and we know that we can't explain why it's warming except by having increased the concentration. So it's really, really plain, and every, you know, leading scientific body says this. There's still a ton of people, though, putting out tons of misinformation and helping create the ongoing gridlock, which we still haven't managed to break.
Here's what I don't understand, Chris. What is their agenda? Why are they fighting against the people who want to try to do something about climate change? What's their agenda?
There's several agendas that are all tied together. One of them is sort of a corporate don't regulate me agenda, where there's a lot of companies that benefit from the status quo. That's changing, though, because a lot of big corporations, GE, BP, and so forth, have actually decided that they want to get on board and they want to create different sources of energy and they want to prepare themselves for a post-carbon future. So the corporate angle doesn't fully explain it anymore. There's a libertarian political angle, where if you don't think government should be getting involved in people's lives, then global warming is sort of the ultimate of the thing you hate because it requires government to massively intervene in the economy.
Yeah, I wonder how those people feel about clean air and clean water.
Right. Well, that, you know, they've got arguments for that stuff, too, I can assure you.
So they were unhappy that Richard Nixon signed those bills in the early 70s that made us all healthier?
Probably. I mean, there's a fairly dramatic you know, the famous quotation, I forget who it is they want to get, you know, government down shrunk and small enough so that they can strangle it in the bathtub. And, you know, Ronald Reagan was a big attacker of government. And, you know, the less government, the better has been the idea. Well, global warming emphatically requires more government. It doesn't just require more U.S. government. It requires global government. It requires, you know, the United Nations and everybody agreeing to a treaty. And all of this is anathema to certain parts of the U.S. political right.
I got to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about global warming and all the rest of this that comes under the category of Unscientific America. That's the name of the new book by Chris Mooney. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown on the Big 550 KTRS.
This is The Mindset.
Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown and talking with Chris Mooney, co-author with Cheryl Kirshenbaum, of a terrific new book called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. He talks about science denial and concepts like how vaccinations lead to herd immunity and keep us safe. Meanwhile, there is such a suppression of scientific information, particularly when it comes to climate change. Last year, I understand, Chris, that you were one of the people leading the rush to try to get a science debate going on during the presidential election. I don't mean having the candidates talk about these topics within their own campaigns, but actually get on stage and have a discussion of science in a public forum, right?
That's right. This is sort of more the positive side of what I try to do. I mean, you hear me criticizing people who are putting out misinformation, but we also want to get Americans more engaged with science and how it affects them. And there was no better way than to try to get the candidates during the, you know, this intensely watched, followed election to talk about the subject. We didn't succeed in getting a national television debate, but we did mobilize tons of leading institutions of American science behind the cause. And we got written answers from the candidates laying out their policy positions so people could compare and contrast them.
Has Obama lived up to it?
Obama has been quite a leader in terms of science. I'm here at MIT, and he was just here actually giving an energy speech. You know, in terms of the scientists that he's put in government in order to advise him, I mean, they are the best, and everybody is really impressed, and he really, really talks the talk. I want to see more progress on global warming, though.
You want him to do more about global warming?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he needs to go to Copenhagen in December, and he needs to make a deal. You know, he needs to make this happen.
What was the reason last year that he and McCain didn't want to have a face-to-face debate in public about science?
Well, we don't have an official reason.
What do you think? You know,
I think that there are a lot of savvy political campaign advisors who are very afraid of what would happen if this kind of event was held. They're afraid that their candidate might goof up and, you know, get the subatomic particles names wrong or something like that, and, you know, and look like Dan Quayle.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there's some risk, but we were arguing there's some reward, and that it wasn't a factual quiz, and it wasn't intended to be, and that's not what we designed. So,
but it would have been simple questions like, "Do you believe in evolution?"
Yeah, that would be fair game. Although, actually, you know, we did not in our 14 questions for the candidates include one about evolution. And the reason is not only that it's hotly contested. I mean, that's not a good reason, but because the president doesn't make evolution policy.
Right.
The states do. But you know, if there was a debate, and who knows who would be in charge of the questions, there's all these negotiations that go on about that kind of stuff. I could easily see an evolution question, but the goal was to have them talk about policy, not to have them talk about, you know, the facts.
And to talk about stopping the suppression of scientific information, which was going on during the Bush years.
Yeah, that would be a key policy topic, and in fact, that was one of the questions. Global warming was one of the questions. How will your administration promote, you know, scientific innovation was one of the questions. New advances in genetics, how are you going to handle that, things like that.
What's the media's role in all this?
Unfortunately, it's fairly negative. You know, there's a lot of problems with the way the media sort of jumps on a brand new scientific study that's just out and seems hot, but it might not be right. And then, you know, 6 months later, they might jump on a study that says exactly the opposite thing. So people get what's called media whiplash, you know, and they distrust not only the media but the scientists who the media are relying upon. So there's a lot of problems. And plus now, you know, science coverage in the press is in decline. Journalists who used to cover science have lost a ton of jobs at newspapers and at some other kinds of outlets, including at CNN. So the media, due to financial reasons and changing technology, e.g. the Internet, is cutting back its science coverage. So this is a real, real worry as well.
Isn't there also a problem with this BS about balance? I mean, there are certain issues where there aren't really two sides, but media outlets would have an esteemed scientist on one side talking about climate change and some right-wing whack job on the other side, and they would feel like we have to give these equal time because we want to offer balance. Which is essentially like telling an NFL player that they should debate a peewee football guy about strategy on a Sunday.
Yeah. I mean, it's nuts. And unfortunately, not only has this approach prevailed, it's a way of abdicating journalistic responsibility, saying, I can't tell you who's credible and who isn't, so I'm just going to give them 50-50 time.
Right.
But it's even worse if you lose the science journalists in the press, which is what's happening. They were the ones that knew why this was not the right thing to do, because they understand the science world. But they're gone. So you're going to have some intern doing this story, right? So they don't have to pay them as much.
Or some anchor who is doing a story and has 30 things that they have to do in the course of an hour and is reading mostly off of a teleprompter written by some minimum wage writer in the back room.
Exactly. And so they're going to be snowed, and why wouldn't they be? They don't have time to really have a bullshit detector. So, yeah.
Chris, has all of this disinformation helped spark the scientific community to speak up more?
It's happening. It's slowly happening. This is, you know, academic institutions and scientific institutions can be a bit sluggish in terms of adapting to change, but it's a new trend. People are very interested in science communication, very interested in how to do it well and how not to do it. There's a number of books out, including not just ours, that talk about different ways for scientists to communicate.
The book is called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Chris Mooney, terrific job on the book. Continue being an advocate for this because we need more voices like yours.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining me today. I'm Paul Harris, filling in for John Brown on the Big 550 KTRS.